This is 1A. I'm Sasha Ann Simons in Washington. Dozens of states report surges in coronavirus cases as President Trump pushes for schools to open in the fall. The Supreme Court clears the way for prosecutors to get President Trump's financial records. And the hit Broadway musical Hamilton is under fire for how it portrays slaveholders. It's the domestic news roundup, and there's lots of national news to talk about. So let's get right to it. We have three smart people to hash through it all with us today. First up is Jane Costin. She's a senior politics reporter at Vox. Jane, welcome back to 1A.
Thanks so much for having me.
Anita Kumar is a White House correspondent and associate editor at Politico. Hi, Anita. Thanks for joining us.
Hi. Thanks for having me back.
And Cheryl Gay Stolberg is a Washington correspondent covering health policy with the New York Times. Hi, Cheryl. Welcome back.
Hi. Hi. Thanks for having me.
Now, the number of coronavirus cases in the U.S. passed 3 million this week. Daily cases hit an all-time high on Wednesday. So, Cheryl, I'm going to start with you. Tell us, what does this mean? Are major shutdowns and restrictions in our near future?
I would say they're in our present.
Yeah.
We're seeing governors around the country and local officials as well roll back some of the reopening. In New Mexico, for instance, the governor there, Michelle Lujan Grisham, announced that effective Monday there would be no more indoor dining at restaurants. Fall contact sports at schools were canceled. I think Texas rolled back some restrictions. Reinstituted some restrictions. I did some reporting in Tennessee. So we are seeing that, and we are going to see that around the country.
Now, coronavirus-related deaths have not seen a similar surge, but many of the intensive care units are becoming overwhelmed. So, Anita, do we expect to see a surge in coronavirus deaths? Infections are rising fast in many of the states.
Yeah, you know, that's the one thing that the president and others keep saying is people aren't talking about the death rate, which is actually, as you mentioned, not as high. It's the infection rate that's going up. But you mentioned the hospitals. You know, with this infection rate being so high, you know, it's the shortage of beds that, you know, governors and local officials are worried about. It's the shortage of tests. It's the shortage of supplies. So, you know, even if the death rate does not go up, it's still these supplies and tests that are needed around the country. And these states that didn't have to deal with it in the beginning, you know, that weren't New York and New Jersey that really got hard hit, are having to deal with that now.
Arizona and Florida have more confirmed cases per capita than any other country in the world. And Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti is warning of a national testing emergency. He says that if infections continue to rise, he'll impose a new round of stay-at-home orders. Now, Cheryl, you actually wrote a story this week about the limitations of testing. In fact, you mentioned it right there in your headline. You said we can't test our way out of this. Tell us why an increase in testing isn't slowing the spread of this virus.
It's because the virus is outpacing the testing. So governors around the country tried to ramp up their testing throughout the spring, and many of them did, but they still weren't testing enough. And in order to stay one step ahead of the virus, you've got to test. The experts say that states should see a positivity rate, the percentage of tests coming back positive, of 5% or lower. That's how they know they're staying ahead of the virus and keeping it in check. The virus is now spreading. It's spreading through asymptomatic people. The testing isn't keeping up. And that is why, that gets us back to the first question you asked me about restrictions.
Mm-hmm.
That's why governors are having to reimpose restrictions, because they, not only are they not testing enough to assess the epidemic, they're running out of tests. Now we have a testing shortage. So we're in this kind of vicious cycle that is not good. This is not good news.
Another vicious cycle, you know, the racial disparities with connected with coronavirus. We've done lots of reporting on this, but we got a better understanding of the racial disparities this week. The New York Times sued the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and it published a detailed map of the data this week. Can you lay that out for us, Cheryl? What did we learn from the data?
Well, we learned that Blacks and Latinos are three times as likely as whites to become infected and two times as likely to die. I would say that there's a note of caution here. The data includes cases through the end of May, and so it doesn't reflect the recent surge. And I suspect, and public health experts suspect, that things may change because a lot of the recent surge is among young people in states where they reopened and young people went out to bars. You heard Tony Fauci say at a hearing a week or so ago, you know, you got to close down the bars. And so they're expecting, for instance, in Tennessee, which I wrote about, mm-hmm. there was a big surge in young non-Hispanic white professionals who were in Nashville and out partying. So the data may change, but still we are seeing terrible racial disparities, and it really does reflect the systemic racism in our healthcare system.
Meanwhile, President Trump is scheduled to hold a rally in New Hampshire this weekend. The top health official in Tulsa, Oklahoma, says a surge in new cases there is actually likely linked to the rally that the president held in that city last month. Jane, can you tell us about the surge in cases in Tulsa?
Yeah, I think that it's interesting because the connection between specific events and a surge in cases is challenging. And I think that that's something we've been hearing from public health professionals over the last couple of weeks, that sometimes the protests against police brutality have led to an increase in cases. Sometimes they haven't. Sometimes that rally in Tulsa, specifically because it was an indoor rally. And already we've seen some prominent people, Herman Cain, for example, test positive for coronavirus. Cain has been hospitalized for coronavirus. So I think that it's pretty clear that these indoor events in which people are close together. Social distancing was discouraged at that event and at the event held at Mount Rushmore. And so I think it's interesting how these different events may have some correlation to one another. For instance, outdoor events causing fewer infections, indoor events causing more. And that's why we're starting to hear conversation about that the Republican National Convention could be moved to an outdoor space this year.
Mm-hmm. Cheryl, you've been looking at this too. Anything to add about what's happening in Tulsa?
Well, I think that this is not rocket science. Like in medicine, they say when you hear hoofbeats, think horses, don't think zebras. And what they mean by that is like, look at the obvious. So President Trump got a lot of people together at a rally in Tulsa. And 2 weeks later, cases are on the rise in Tulsa. So while it is true that you cannot draw a direct line, you know, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that the president created a situation in which Americans were at risk of contracting the virus, and they did.
Anita, does the president actually need to do a rally in New Hampshire? How important is it to him winning in November?
Well, it is a swing state. It's on the list of, you know, battleground states. I would note that the president had said when he announced that he was going to do rallies again, that he did, of course, mention Oklahoma would be the first. But he mentioned other states that he was going to go to. He was mentioning Florida and North Carolina. And Florida, as you mentioned earlier, is having a surge. You know, he's actually going there today. He's not going there for this rally, though. They're bypassing that place. North Carolina still has orders that you can't have more than 25 people gathered together. So he chose New Hampshire. The governor is letting him do this event, but they are making some changes, and it's a little bit unclear how many people are going to come. One is they are encouraging masks. Last time, and they're giving out masks, and also this is going to be mostly an outdoor venue. So they're changing that around. But I think the Trump campaign was a little bit taken by surprise at how many people didn't come because they were still worried. And so when they have this RSVP, you sign up for tickets, it's a little bit unclear now how many people are going to come.
In California, more than 1,300 inmates at San Quentin State Prison have tested positive for coronavirus. The prison was coronavirus-free less than 2 months ago. Jane, there are a lot of people that are saying that this could have been prevented. How did it happen?
It happened because prison officials didn't take care with basic cleanliness. This has always been a big concern because America's prison systems, for one thing, are so, in many cases, so disconnected from the general public, except for people who have family who are incarcerated. And people were, speaking out, writing letters to journalists and to others and to family members asking for help, and especially in crowded conditions without adequate sanitation, that is the perfect recipe for the outbreak of a disease that is spread through close contact and a lack of available hand washing facilities.
Christine emails us. This is a question I want to pose to you, Cheryl. When the number of coronavirus cases is reported for an individual state or city, does that represent a point in time or a historical number? In other words, the number of cases ever reported for that state, including people who have died or those who are currently sick, both at home and in hospital?
I think it does not represent those who are currently sick. States gather data based on daily new infections, but they also gather total. So it's, in a sense, it's both, but I don't think that they can track who is sick at any given time. They can track the number of new infections each day, and that's what we're seeing in the numbers. We're seeing total numbers of deaths mm-hmm. and total numbers of infections.
As we take a pause here, we'd like to take a moment to remember the life of Charlie Daniels. The singer, songwriter, and bandleader was a force in both country and rock for decades. Here's some masterful fiddling from his hit, The Devil Went Down to Georgia. He died from a stroke on Monday in Nashville, Tennessee, at the age of 83. It's the News Roundup with Jane Costin, a senior politics reporter at Vox, Anita Kumar, White House correspondent and associate editor at Politico, and Cheryl Gay Stolberg. She's a Washington correspondent covering health policy with the New York Times. And I'm Sasha Ann Simons. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
When the devil finished, Johnny said, "Well, you're pretty good, old son. But sit down in that chair right there and let me show you how it's done. Fire on the mountain, run, boys, run. The devil's in the house of the rising sun. Chicken in the bread pan, picking out dough. Granny, there's your dog bite, no child, no."
Whenever you face a choice, it helps to think like an economist. And this week on Planet Money Summer School, we'll start off our course in economics with a workout for your brain, how to decide what something truly costs. Listen now to Planet Money from NPR.
I'm Sasha Ann Simons. We're talking about the week's top national headlines with Jane Costin. She's a senior politics reporter at Vox. Anita Kumar is a White House correspondent and associate editor at Politico. And Cheryl Gay Stolberg, Washington correspondent covering health policy with the New York Times. Now, Anita, in Arizona, nearly half the employees at an Immigration and Customs Enforcement detention center have tested positive for coronavirus. And migrants that are being detained say that they've basically been abandoned because the staff keeps dwindling because of these infections. What's happening there?
Yeah, I think there's a couple really important things about this story. One is ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency, doesn't publicly report the number of employees infected. So it's really, we really don't know what those numbers look like anywhere. And it could be a lot higher. We just have no idea. But you're right. Even though the agency is pushing back on this, there are detainees that have said lots of things, that employees aren't wearing masks, or they are wearing them, but they're taking them off to talk. That the masks that are around are the same masks and they're not being changed out. Someone might have a mask for a month. So the agency is really pushing back on all this and saying, no, no, we've established all these precautions and, you know, health, you know, different actions since April, and this isn't the case. But there's clearly something going on here if the numbers are as high as are being reported.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the big questions facing local leaders right now, let's take a turn here to politics, is what to do about reopening schools. It's a big question, and the president has made clear what he wants to happen.
We hope that most schools are going to be open. We don't want people to make political statements or do it for political reasons. They think it's going to be good for them politically, so they keep the schools closed. No way. So we're very much going to put pressure on governors and everybody else to open the schools, to get them open. And it's very important. It's very important for our country. It's very important for the well-being of the student and the parents. So we're going to be putting a lot of pressure on open your schools in the fall.
And the president has attacked current CDC guidelines for reopening, dismissing them as, quote, very tough and expensive in a tweet. Cheryl, what are those CDC guidelines for reopening?
Well, the CDC has put out lengthy guidelines, including a detailed checklist for how to reopen, and they give schools and school districts a basic guidance of risk. That's where it begins. So a low risk would be a virtual classroom. A high risk would be full-size in-person classes. And the middle risk would be small in-person classes and activities, which, of course, would require a lot of adjusting for school. They're recommending that students be kept in small groups. Mm-hmm. They're not mandating anything, but it's clear from the recommendations they're suggesting that students remain 6 feet apart and don't share objects, have the same teacher throughout school days, don't have groups mixing, so that can upend activities like art, let's say, or if you had a reading specialist. So it's going to be a lot of work for schools to reopen safely.
And there's still so much uncertainty. Are they going to be updated?
Well, this was a matter of contention between the president and the director of the CDC this week. When the president criticized the guidelines, the CDC director, Robert Redfield, said at first, well, we'll revise them. And then I suspect there was a mini uproar inside the CDC suggesting that Dr. Redfield was maybe cowing to political pressure from the president. So instead, he said most recently that they would not revise them, but they would provide additional reference documents. I'm not sure what those documents will be, but it sounds like he was threading a needle there.
Well, President Trump also threatened to cut school funding if they don't open. And here's what Education Secretary Betsy DeVos said on Fox when she was asked about it.
Well, American investment in education is a promise to our students and families. And if schools aren't going to reopen, we're not suggesting pulling funding from education, but instead allowing families let the families take that money and figure out where their kids can get educated if their schools are going to refuse to open.
Cheryl, can Trump withdraw funding?
Well, as we know, education is a local matter. So I think it is possible for him to withdraw perhaps some federal support for some school activities. I'm thinking of perhaps school lunch programs. I just can't imagine the president withdrawing federal support for that. But really, schools are funded locally. They're funded by local tax dollars. And the president himself campaigned against efforts to nationalize education in 2016. So I think his hands are, if not completely tied, a little bit tied.
Anita, you heard Cheryl lay it out for us, but, you know, tell us why reopening schools is so important to President Trump.
Yeah, thanks. I did some reporting on this week, and I talked to a lot of people that are close to the White House and in the White House and to the Trump campaign. And as you know, the president has been talking for months now about getting this economy moving again. Mm-hmm. You know, he had planned at the beginning of the year before the pandemic, if we can remember that far ago, he had planned on really running for reelection this year on this really strong economy, the stock market, job growth, wages, and all that got wiped away with the coronavirus. And so now his plan, really what he has going for him at this point, the silver lining here is that he could run for reelection on this idea that, look, I restored the economy once, so he says, and I can do it again. And polls are showing that while he's very much down in battleground states and national polls, sort of the one little area he has is that some voters, a lot of voters, are saying they trust President Trump more than Joe Biden to fix the economy. So he really wants that economy going again. He wants it to make some significant gains before the election. And it all goes back to that. Parents can't go to work. The economy can't get moving unless children are in daycares and schools.
Now, this week, a surprise retirement. Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Vindman made headlines during the president's impeachment hearings last fall. But on Wednesday, he announced he's retiring after 21 years in the military. And the reason, quote, through a campaign of bullying, intimidation, and retaliation, the president of the United States attempted to force Lieutenant Colonel Vindman to choose between adhering to the law or pleasing a president. Set the stage for us, Anita. What led to this?
Well, you know, if you'll remember, back to the impeachment trial, seems like forever ago, Vindman was one of the people that came forward, and he had heard the call between President Trump and the Ukraine leader. Remember, this was when the president had sort of indicated that he wanted Ukraine to look into Joe Biden and Joe Biden's son, Hunter Biden, and what money the Hunter Biden had gotten there in Ukraine in a deal. And so he raised a red flag, and he reported it. He thought it was inappropriate. And so since the impeachment, we've seen he was relieved of his duties at the White House, at the National Security Council. His brother also worked there and was relieved of those duties, but he had stayed on generally, and he had been waiting for a promotion. And that wasn't coming through. And instead of continuing to wait, it's a little bit unclear what was going to happen with that. We've gotten some conflicting information about whether they were going to let that go through or not. Instead of waiting, he has decided to retire because he says it's all retaliation from his, you know, raising his hand during the impeachment trial.
Jane, why is this happening now?
I mean, I think that it's pretty clear that this is happening as a result of the impeachment trial, which while most Americans with coronavirus, with so many of the other issues that we're dealing with, I think for many Americans that has kind of passed from our memory, but clearly not for Trump and the administration, which is taking it out on this person. And I would also say that it's so deeply concerning to see the long-ranging effects of speaking out, especially speaking out in a means that which, you know, Trump was not impeached by the Senate. Trump remains in the presidency, and yet this person, you know, has been forced out of their career as a result.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of speaking out, Jane, Mary Trump, which is the president's niece, she's speaking out. She has a new memoir coming out next week, but some highlights have already been shared. Can you tell us what we know so far about what's in it?
Well, the description of a house of absolute horrors has been used. And wow. I think that the book for me is more evidence that we already had of the president's upbringing. A president's upbringing that seems to be deeply, in many cases, disturbing. I don't agree with efforts to psychologize the president or psychologize people with whom we don't know personally. But I do think that this is indicative of a family environment that perhaps shaped the president into the person he is today. I would also say, though, that I think in many cases, this book is a bit of a distraction. This book tells us information that many of us, if we didn't know it, we kind of already thought it for many people. And I don't think it's going to get many people, to change their views on the president. And especially at this particular moment, it seems a little distracting.
Yeah, it's called Too Much and Never Enough: How My Family Created the World's Most Dangerous Man. I just wonder how many surprises will be in there.
I think that there are going to be some surprises, but I also think, this is another instance in which I think the White House has never heard of the Streisand effect, in which attempting to curtail a story or stop a story from being spread actually makes it spread more. Release of this book was moved up due to public interest, despite the White House's efforts to stop the book's publication. And so I think that there's going to be, we're going to learn from this book more about the family dynamics within the Trump family, which have always been a little, part of the discussion. But I think that for many people who read this book, it's going to reinforce views that they may have already had.
Nita, Jane actually just mentioned briefly the lawsuit to stop distribution of the book. Can you tell us what's going on with that?
Yeah, I mean, the point is sort of moot now. There was a lawsuit. There still is a lawsuit. And I believe that there's a hearing on it coming up. But the publisher has already shipped out, I think, thousands of books. This is how it works. They ship out books so that journalists can review the book, talk about the book beforehand. And so what you've seen is in newspapers all across the country and TV stations and in media outlets all across the country, the book is already out there. They're not even just excerpts. Reporters have the entire book. So they can still try to push it off. I mean, we have a copy of the book. So they can still try to stop it. But at this point, it seems it's moot. And it's supposed to come out on Tuesday.
So let's switch gears here and talk about this pipeline issue. This week, major blows to oil and gas pipelines. A federal judge ruled the Dakota Access Pipeline must halt production pending an environmental review. and the utility companies pursuing the Atlantic Coast Pipeline gave the project up. So, Anita, tell us what happened to the Atlantic Coast Pipeline.
So there's two things. Are you talking about the Dakota Pipeline?
Yes.
Two different pipelines have happened this week that have gone away this week, I guess. This Dakota Access Pipeline was going to be through North Dakota and Illinois, and it was, like many of these pipelines, tied up in legal battles. And what has happened is that it has been stopped because they, you know, environmental groups and Native Americans had protested this. And what the court is saying is that they needed an environmental impact statement, the type that they did not have. So it's not completely stopped. It can go on, but this is a huge victory for those people that have been fighting for it. I did mention another one. There was another pipeline that was supposed to go through over on the East Coast, and environmentalists had pushed on, back on that. And that was also stopped because it also faced legal hurdles, and they had decided that there was too much going on. It would cost too much money to go ahead with it.
Where would that one have been, that second one?
I believe that was West Virginia.
Okay. Jane, what does the ruling mean for the Dakota Access Pipeline?
Well, I think it takes it back to the same, the sense of stasis that we had before. I think that it's interesting because both of these pipelines have been the subject of so much legal action, and these rulings don't mean that the Dakota Access Pipeline, will not ultimately be finished or happen, but it does mean that the legal wrangling will continue.
Why is this so important? Can you
I think it's incredibly important because the Dakota Access Pipeline and these pipelines in general really pitted in not only environmental activists, but folks from Native American communities on whose land these pipelines were being passed. And if we remember that, the protests against these pipelines were responded to with incredible violence from state authorities and from law enforcement. And so I think that for many people, the memory of those experiences is still fresh in their minds. And so I think that, while the legal wrangling will continue, I think that the community that's developed to protest and to stop the development of these pipelines, I think that community has only grown stronger.
Now let's switch gears to the Supreme Court. This was the last week of the term for the Supreme Court, and the justices announced several major decisions. Jane, I'm kicking it back to you. On Thursday, the High Court cleared the way for prosecutors in New York to see President Trump's financial records. But I want to back up just a bit. Can you remind us what the case was about? What was the New York prosecutor seeking and why?
So the New York prosecutor was seeking information on the Trump family and the Trump's financial records. And so I think that one of the really interesting things about this case, and I'm grabbing a comment here, was that the Trump argued that he had absolute immunity from state criminal prosecutions and essentially said that, that the ability of Congress and state prosecutors to subpoena documents related to his run for president or the win or the alleged hush payments made with regard to the Stormy Daniels case, if anyone remembers that. Right. It feels like it was thousands of years
ago.
Right,
sure does.
But the court basically found that Trump does not have a special shield against that subpoena of his records. And so I think that one of the interesting things, though, is that I think it was, this ruling when it came out was first positioned as a major victory against Trump. But the court made the case that Congress needs to clarify their standard for the, for receiving these financial records and for congressional subpoenas in general. So it was actually kind of a mixed ruling in many ways.
Well, we got a tweet from Kokomo Kid. He says, "It doesn't matter. The Trump fans don't care how corrupt he is. And learning a little more about his corruption from tax returns won't change much." We'll talk about the week's top national stories a bit more when we get back from this quick pause. We're talking with Jane Costin, a senior politics reporter at Vox, Anita Kumar, White House correspondent and associate editor at Politico, and Cheryl Gay Stolberg, Washington correspondent with The New York Times. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. We'll hear from you and from our guests in just a moment.
These days, Chelsea Handler tries to keep her and her friend's white privilege in check.
She starts, like, really getting weepy, and I was like, well, what are you doing right now? You just said you read White Fragility. You cannot talk about reading White Fragility and start to cry.
Comedian Chelsea Handler on white privilege and a new book. Listen to It's Been a Minute from NPR.
Now back to the domestic news roundup with Jane Costin, a senior politics reporter at Vox, Anita Kumar, White House correspondent and associate editor at Politico, and Cheryl Gay Stolberg, Washington correspondent with the New York Times. Let's pick this up where we left off. The Supreme Court ruling for New York prosecutors looking to see President Trump's financial records. Anita, this was a major defeat for the president with a 7-2 opinion written by Chief Justice John Roberts. What was the majority's reasoning in this case?
Well, I think Jane mentioned is that the president is not immune, that prosecutors can get his tax records. But this does have to go back to the prosecutor to go to a grand jury. It wasn't, you know, there was so much confusion about the Supreme Court rulings on these taxes. What the Supreme Court said is, if a grand jury deems it necessary for a prosecutor to look at it, they can. It still has to go through all the hurdles. It's just that the president can't be completely immune, which is what he was saying. So a grand jury could get those records. A prosecutor could get those records. If you don't mind, in the other case, I'll just tell you, the other case with the House, they sent it back to a lower court. So yeah. It was a mixed ruling.
Yeah, and I was actually going to ask Cheryl a bit more about that, because in the second ruling, the justices rejected congressional demands for President Trump's financial records. Tell us more about that and why the court ruled differently here.
Well, the court ruled that a lower court was going to have to consider whether or not Congress had acted too expansively. They sent it back to the lower court. I think the Supreme Court actually determined that Congress had acted expansively, and they sent it to the lower court to determine whether Congress could narrow its request. And, you know, at the heart of both of these cases are questions about whether third-party companies can be compelled to produce the president's personal documents. And
can
the
they?
Congress, well, that seems to be the that seems to be the question here. And it's, I don't think we have an answer to that question yet. The rulings were not good for Congress. Speaker Nancy Pelosi tried to spin it as a reaffirmation of Congress's subpoena power to obtain documents from the executive branch, which, you know, this Congress has been very assertive in putting forth. But these rulings could actually permanently curb Congress's power. And I think we have yet to see how expansive that power will be in the end. That's going to work its way through the court system once again.
Now, President Trump also claims that he's being treated unfairly by the court, even though the two justices he appointed, Brett Kavanaugh and Neil, they voted against in the New York case. And so he spoke on Thursday about the SCOTUS rulings and the New York investigation. Let's listen.
This is a political witch hunt, the likes of which nobody's ever seen before. It's a pure witch hunt. It's a hoax, just like the Mueller investigation was a hoax that I won.
Jane, what does this mean for the investigations into the president by congressional committees and the New York prosecutor?
Well, what's interesting to me is that I don't think that, for one thing, we should not expect to learn anything additional until after the election, which is going to be quite interesting, I think, for many people, because there's an idea on both sides that either this investigation by the New York prosecutors or by Congress, when this comes back to Congress, I think that there's a sense that none of this is going to result in some sort of giant bombshell that will come before the election. But I also think that there's really a sense that this is a conversation that is not the conversation most Americans are having right now. We're in the midst of a pandemic. We're in the midst of a pandemic that might kill 200,000 Americans by the end of this year. A pandemic that, as we've discussed earlier, is out of control in many respects. And so I think that, you know, this debate, if you follow conservative media, you may have heard a little bit about the investigation that's taking place led by Durham and with Attorney General Barr, which is supposed to be, if you're a conservative, supposed to be a bombshell that will prove that Obama and Biden were knee deep in a conspiracy to entrap the president. And none of this is probably going to be resolved before the election, which I think would be a disappointment to many people. But also, I think so much of this is a distraction, and it's a distraction for the president. It's a distraction for people who dislike the president. It's a distraction for everyone involved.
And just to put a bow on this, could Trump's tax records or other documents be released?
Not right now. I think that the information that we have right now, it indicates that there's there's a silver lining for Trump in that, because the court didn't order Trump to turn over those records, they sent this back to a district court so that the Trump's attorneys can make another argument opposing the subpoena. Mm-hmm. So this could go before the Supreme Court again, and it could be more than a year before any of this is settled.
Anita, the Supreme Court also ruled on a case in Oklahoma that could have far-reaching implications for Native Americans. What was that case about?
Yeah, in that case, the Supreme Court ruled that much of eastern Oklahoma actually belongs to Native Americans. And this was a really, really big case for Native Americans. They have tried in a lot of different cases for so long to say, basically that the United States has taken their land. The United States made a deal with Native Americans back in the 1800s when it pushed them from the southeast west and said that they could have the land that was west, but then has sort of taken over. So, the implications of this could be really far-reaching, and they have to sort of work out what it means. But essentially what this case was about was whether Native Americans who are charged, criminally charged, by local and state officials there, whether they could be charged or whether they really had to go through the tribe's criminal justice system. And so what this will do is take these people that are being charged and really say, okay, they have to be charged through their own system. But it could have far-reaching implications about taxes and zoning and so forth. But it was a huge victory for them. This is something that they've been trying in various places over time. I just recently reported someone had mentioned the president had gone to Mount Rushmore, and I recently reported about that and how there was a Supreme Court case on Mount Rushmore is on, the Black Hills. In that case, the Supreme Court gave Native Americans money, said they had to have money as compensation. They don't want compensation. Mm-hmm. They actually want the land back. And that's why this was so important.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, what's the practical impact on this ruling on criminal justice in eastern Oklahoma? And also, the ruling could have far-reaching implications for other Native American cases, right?
I definitely agree. I think that a lot of people are going to be looking at this case and saying, look, in other states and other places like South Dakota, maybe we can go to court and maybe this will work now. I mean, it was really, really telling. It was a 5-4 decision. The liberal justices on one side, as well as Neil Gorsuch, one of President Trump's appointees to the Supreme Court, who is from the West and has sided with Native Americans on other issues like this. He actually wrote the opinion and said, if we made this bargain with them, if we made this deal with Native Americans 100, 200 years ago, then we have to stick by it.
I want to make a quick clarification for when we were talking earlier about the Atlantic Coast Pipeline. It was a planned natural gas pipeline slated to run about 600 miles from West Virginia through Virginia to eastern North Carolina. The pipeline is actually no longer moving forward. And Cheryl, also this week, the Supreme Court has made it more difficult for women to access birth control as part of their health plans if their employer has religious or moral objections to contraceptives. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, so this is a case that is the latest in a long-standing and very, very fierce debate over the so-called contraception mandate in the Affordable Care Act, President Obama's signature health care law. And the contraception mandate included an exemption. The law said itself that regulators could create exemptions for employers with religious objections. And the Obama administration, in fact, had adopted one that was limited to houses of worship. This was a much more expansive exercise of the of that. The Trump administration wanted employers to be able to deny contraception coverage to female workers on religious or moral grounds. So this would have been, you know, a broad application of this to employers. And the Supreme Court went along with it. And a big surprise here, big, big surprise, was that Elena Kagan actually joined the majority in this case. She's, of course, a liberal justice, an Obama appointee, mm-hmm. and she had ruled the other way in a similar case in 2014. But she wrote in this case that the Obama administration had, in fact, offered an exemption, and she wrote, even in areas of broad statutory authority, agencies must rationally account for their judgments. So the court returned the case to the appeals court for consideration of other challenges to the regulation. But bottom line, they upheld the Trump administration's regulation that lets employers discriminate and not offer contraceptive coverage to women based on religious grounds.
Anita, this battle, as Cheryl laid out for us, it's been going on for almost a decade since the Affordable Care Act became law. How many people will be impacted by the decision?
Cheryl would probably know better than me, but I think it's about 100, more than 100, 125,000.
Yeah.
Yes. So definitely significant amount of people.
Now let's turn to this so-called cancel culture. This has been a buzzword in headlines in recent weeks. People are putting many popular works of art and entertainment under critical review, including Hamilton. On Monday, Lin-Manuel Miranda responded to the criticism of his play's depiction of slavery with a tweet saying, "All the criticisms are valid. The sheer tonnage of complexities and failings of these people I couldn't get or wrestled with but cut. I took 6 years and fit as much as I could in a 2.5-hour musical. Did my best. It's all fair game." Jane, what are the new criticisms of Hamilton and why are they surfacing right now?
Well, I think I would like first to say that I think that this is a debate that's being largely had among a very small group of people. It just happens that those people are extraordinarily prominent in American culture.
Yeah.
And I think the debate is about, you know, what Hamilton did was take some of the stories of the founding fathers, Alexander Hamilton, Aaron Burr, Thomas Jefferson, and explain those stories and explain who these people were in a new way, featuring actors and actresses who were people of color playing, obviously, an all right group of people. And obviously doing so with figures like Thomas Jefferson and George Washington, both of whom were slave owners. I think that to some was controversial, but I actually don't think it is. I've noticed that there have been numerous pieces, particularly in conservative media, asking, could Hamilton be staged today? Could Hamilton be made today? Almost kind of urging it to be, quote unquote, canceled. Mm-hmm. Hamilton remains incredibly popular, and because it just premiered, a filmed version of the play from 2016 just premiered on Disney Plus, it's getting back into the conversation. I think Lin-Manuel Miranda said that it was a flawed play about flawed people. Mm-hmm. But I would just like to note that I think that this debate is being had amongst people who are privileged enough to take part in it. For many Americans, their experience of this particular moment is one of job loss, one of real challenge. You know, there are people who still haven't gotten the payments that they were supposed to receive from the federal government to help support them during this time. You know, reporter Jeff Stein of the Washington Post shared a post on Twitter from the Reddit thread R Unemployment, where it talks about, you know, someone who's, "No, really, I like sleeping in my car right now. I loved having to surrender my dog to the animal shelter because I couldn't afford to feed her. I'd really like someone to ask this person what they think about, quote unquote, cancel culture."
Yeah. Speaking of cancel culture, this week, a San Francisco lawmaker introduced the Karen Act. The legislation will hold people accountable for making racially motivated 911 calls. We all saw what happened with Amy Cooper in New York. Now, Cheryl, Amy is actually facing possible legal consequences for a call that she made back in May. But the victim of the crime, he says that he's not going to cooperate with the DA and thinks that Amy Cooper has already paid a steep price. So as we talk about cancel culture, just tell us, how is that conversation developing around exactly how people should be held accountable for their actions?
Well, I think that's really interesting. I thought it was fascinating that Christian Cooper decided not to cooperate. He said that if he understands that there may be a principle to uphold, that principle being you cannot call 911 on false grounds, but that if the DA wanted to pursue it, they could pursue it without him. He felt that Amy Cooper had been shamed enough, that she had paid a price. And I think that this is really a reflection of our current internet and social media culture, where we are, in a way, holding one another accountable as a society writ large. When that tweet, that video went viral, there was a storm of criticism for Amy Cooper, and she lost her job. So I think, in a way, this is what societies are supposed to do. We're supposed to hold each other accountable.
She paid a steep price, like Christian Cooper said. We have been talking with Cheryl Gay Stolberg, Washington correspondent with the New York Times, Anita Kumar, White House correspondent and associate editor at Politico, and Jane Costin, a senior politics reporter at Vox. Thank you all for making time for us today. 1A's lead audio engineer and sound designer is Jake Cherry. He gets technical assistance from Ben Privett and Rashad Young. Aileen Humphreys is the producer and editor of 1A On Demand. Gabrielle Healy is our digital editor, and Chris Castano is our digital producer. Our news roundup continues with all of the week's most important international news right after a short break. Stay with us. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. This is 1A.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from K. Buxbaum in support of the David Gilkey and Zabiula Tamana Memorial Fund, established to strengthen NPR's commitment to training and protecting journalists in high-risk environments. Support for NPR comes from Newman's Own Foundation, working to nourish the common good by donating all profits from Newman's Own food products to charitable organizations that seek to make the world a better place. More information is available at newmansownfoundation.org.
This is 1A. I'm Sasha Ann Simons in Washington, and it's time for the international edition of our news roundup. Italy extends its state of emergency. Yet another world leader tests positive for COVID. Hong Kong says it's suspending school. And the UK relaxes rules for visitors from more than 70 countries over the need to self-isolate. America is not on that list. There's a lot to unpack as the world grapples with coronavirus. And here to help us this week is Jessica Donati. She's foreign affairs and State Department reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Hi, Jessica.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Paul Danahar is Washington Bureau Chief for the BBC, author of The New Middle East, the world After the Arab Spring. Hi, Paul. Welcome to 1A.
Thank you very much.
And Nina Maria Potts is the Director of Global News Coverage for Feature Story News. Welcome back, Nina Maria.
Thanks for having me.
Now, we're going to start with China. It was hard to find any branch of the federal government who did not single out the Chinese Communist Party for attack. On Wednesday, the director of the FBI said acts of espionage and theft by China's government posed the, quote, greatest long-term threat to the future of the U.S. Now, here is Christopher Wray speaking to the Hudson Institute in Washington, D.C.
China is engaged in a whole-of-state effort to become the world's only superpower by any means necessary. And at this very moment, China is working to compromise American healthcare organizations, pharmaceutical companies, and academic institutions conducting essential COVID-19 research.
Jessica, any reason why Director Wray went after China so hard this week?
I think, it's been a whole of government thing that we've seen in the past few weeks. And I think that it's an administration-wide offensive against China, because I think they're starting to see that China is also going to be a domestic voting issue in the U.S. And there was an earlier perception that Trump was too soft on China. So now the message is going very much in the opposite direction and trying to convey to sort of every American that China is something that they need to be thinking about and that the administration is going to be tough.
Paul, if we do take Chris Wray at face value, was this speech intended for a particular audience?
I think it was intended for everyone. This is probably the only bipartisan issue in American politics today. And it's probably coming too late because, you know, I was living in China in 2008 when they had their Olympics and everyone talked about it being China's coming out party. And in the last 12 years, they've gone from tentatively, you know, putting their toe in the water of international affairs to now being in what Christopher Wray said was a generational fight to surpass America in economic and technological leadership. And I think basically, you know, it's fortunate in many ways, I think, for America that this has become a big domestic political issue, mm-hmm. because it is something that everybody just didn't tackle quick enough. I mean, there was so much effort in making money out of China over the last sort of 10, 12 years that no one really thought about the long-term implications of what that would mean. And I think, you know, finally now, everyone recognizes that this has to be tackled.
Now, Nina Maria, Director Ray went out of his way to ask Chinese-born people living in the U.S. to contact the FBI if Chinese officials target them seeking their return. What was that about?
Well, I think it's a very uncomfortable time for Chinese people living in the U.S., and certainly we've seen this week an extraordinary decision by the Trump administration to take action against foreign and international students and possibly kick them out if their colleges decide to go entirely online. So, I mean, I think that we're seeing a turning point in the relationship between the U.S. And China, and to Paul and Jessica's point, there's also been a tidal wave of reaction to China's new national security laws stretching from New Zealand and Australia to India, Canada, the UK even, and Germany and France are pushing for EU countermeasures against China. And the tide has turned. Where I'm standing here in the UK, national security concerns are now prompting Boris Johnson to possibly do a U-turn on allowing Huawei to build out its 5G network. India as well has halted any 5G trials. I think the point is, as Paul said, more countries are beginning to see China as a national security threat.
We'll talk about more about what's going on with the tech giant in a little bit. But Jessica, not to second guess anyone here, and before we move forward, you know, how worried are those in national security about what China is up to?
I mean, I think that it's something that's been building up over months in the national security area. Secretary Pompeo, every time he's gone visiting any country, whether it's somewhere in Southeast Asia or Eastern Europe, he's campaigned to warn governments against taking on Chinese technology. He's warned about Huawei and ZTE. And so I think this is something that has been a huge concern for the national security sector for a long time. I think more recently, especially with coronavirus now making China a very tangible concern for everybody, that it's kind of it's come out into a more general sort of sector.
Now, in another move, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said this week that the administration was looking at banning Chinese apps, including the hugely popular TikTok. Secretary Pompeo then went further on Wednesday when he was briefing reporters at the State Department. In essence, he said TikTok was just one of many targets.
The comments that I made about a particular company earlier this week fall in the context of us evaluating the threat from the Chinese Communist Party. We've talked about it in the context of ZTE, we've talked about it in the context of Huawei, and we are now evaluating each instance where we believe that U.S. citizens' data that they have on their phones or in their system or in their healthcare records, we want to make sure that the Chinese Communist Party doesn't have a way to easily access that.
Jessica, my kids at home are freaking out about a potential TikTok ban. Is this real?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is. India, for example, banned TikTok pretty much overnight, and they are China's not the main user after China. So I think it's something that the U.S. could very well do. I don't know how long it would take, but I think your kids are probably right to be concerned.
Yeah, they just turned the radio up for sure. Stephen writes to us on Facebook. He says, these kids are smart and will quickly adapt. Ban TikTok, another platform will surface. And Dan also emailed us and said, TikTok has some seriously sketchy stuff going on with the way it operates and seems singularly designed to spy on its users. Nina Maria, does that square with what we've been hearing?
Well, I think one of the most interesting things about the administration weighing up a ban on TikTok is how that might even work. I mean, the most effective app bans essentially block any communication between the targeted app and its users. That's basically how China does it, how India has managed to enforce its recent TikTok ban. And by the way, India has banned 59 Chinese apps recently.
Wow.
Australia is also thinking about doing the same thing. But whether U.S. law has any precedent for blocking software in that way it's very unclear, I think, how could the White House actually enforce that kind of censorship? I just don't know. The ban on TikTok already exists for a lot of government employees on their work phones and also the U.S. military. But, I mean, could this lead to a generalized ban in the U.S. Where you have something like the China sort of firewall? I'm not so sure.
Now, Paul, if you can square this circle for us, you know, you have a president who's evidently pleased with his new trade deal with China, and then you have the State Department and the FBI that's telling us China's a massive threat. So has the message changed because we're now months away from an election?
I think the message has changed because the president recognizes that people are more worried about COVID than they are at the moment, anyway, about the economy. And people are... He's managed, in the way that he's been framing the coronavirus, to pin it to China. And China undoubtedly has a lot of responsibility for it. And I think all these things are coming together. I mean, the India going after China on social media comes off the back of China and India having this conflict up in the Himalayas. It just feels like China is in a rush. And perhaps because they don't know what the next president's going to look like, next administration is going to look like, mm-hmm. that they are trying to kind of push as fast as they possibly can to get as many of the things that they want before another administration comes in. Because it does seem to be a kind of rapid pace of China pushing for all the things that it's been kind of quietly trying to get over the last few years.
Well, Paul, in another sign of growing Chinese confidence, the country opened a security office in Hong Kong this week. It will allow mainland intelligence agents to operate openly and oversee China's new strict security law. Do we know if most Hong Kongers have now resigned themselves to the fact that one country, two systems is now a historical footnote?
Well, I think we've only got to look at the way that when people began to protest about it, they were immediately arrested. I think the international community is right to basically say Hong Kong no longer has the freedoms that it did have. And this is an incredibly aggressive, rapid move by China. And it knows that the world at the moment is very, very busy dealing with their own problems. And it's a good time to take action. Now, I don't doubt that there will be economic impacts for Hong Kong. There will be some economic impacts for China. But I think there was a key phrase in Christopher Wray's statement. And it's when he talked about a generational fight. The thing about the Chinese is they don't see things in a four-year cycle. They see things in a 400-year cycle. They are playing a very, very long game. Mm-hmm. And when you're kind of dealing with democracies where things change every 4 years, it means that they can kind of edge their way forward, but they have a long, long vision in the way that we simply don't. So they'll take a little hit now because they're looking at the much bigger picture.
Absolutely. Dina emails us and says, well, the end game for this administration's ramping up of anti-China invective is for Trump to question election results, crying interference. Jessica, Bloomberg reported this week that the White House is weighing proposals to undermine the Hong Kong currency's peg to the U.S. dollar. Now, should we expect the U.S. to help out in the way that the U.K. and Australia have?
What do you mean by help out?
So, you know, with regards to, Hong Kong's currency being undermined.
I think that what we've seen in the last week or so is coordination between the Five Eyes. You have Australia and Canada and the UK, New Zealand, all trying to coordinate in some way in terms of a response to China's crackdown on Hong Kong. Mm-hmm. So I think that you could expect to see further coordination as far as currency goes, but I think the U.S. is taking a step-by-step approach and seeing who plays what card.
Mm-hmm. And I also mentioned steps taken by Australia. Now, this week, Canberra scrapped its extradition treaty with China, and it also took immediate steps to help Hong Kong residents living in Australia. Here's Prime Minister Scott Morrison.
For skilled and graduate visa holders, we'll be extending visas by 5 years from today, with a pathway to permanent residency at the end of those 5 years. Now, that means if you're a current or future student, you'll be able to stay for a total of 5 years once you've graduated, with a pathway to permanent residency at the end of that period.
Now, in context, Nina Maria, Australia is seen as a country with a tough immigration policy. So, was this move significant?
Well, I think there's a sense, certainly a strong sense in Australia, that the government had no choice but to recognise the new reality in Hong Kong and offer people living there a way out. I think Australian and other foreign experts there are suddenly feeling very insecure about the future, especially as it sinks in quite rapidly that they could be deported to the mainland to face prosecution under mainland law if they get into any kind of trouble. I think it's probably worth saying that Australia's relationship with China has been on the rocks for months, mainly because Australia, like several other countries, started pushing China for answers on the origin of the coronavirus pandemic. That, in turn, enraged Beijing. China retaliated with an 80% tariff hike on Australian barley. It suspended some major beef exports. It warned Chinese students not to travel to Australia, basically calling Australia racist. So all this has prompted a massive debate in Australia over how much it really needs China, and economically I fear it does. So the question now is, how far is Australia prepared to go before it starts to risk damaging its economy because of its reliance on China?
Now, before we move on, to round off the news from China, let's note some news out of the UK that concerns the tech giant Huawei. Paul, is it best to begin with the basics here? Like, just tell us why this company is in the middle of the Venn diagram over international relations with China.
Well, the UK originally said it was happy for Huawei to be involved in building up the UK's 5G network. And it said that they wouldn't allow Huawei to be anywhere near things that were sensitive in terms of for intelligence gathering. But it has been dragged into the growing concerns about China and the way that it basically goes around hoovering up as much information as it possibly can, and to what extent Huawei is not entirely independent of the Chinese Communist Party. And I think actually the language that everybody's been using in the last few months is interesting, because we used to talk about China and the Chinese government. In the last couple of months, the language has gone very Cold War. Everyone's talking about the Chinese Communist Party. And I think that's a change, that's a recognition that the international community is no longer going to kind of deal with China as a normal government. It's basically saying, this is who we're dealing with, this is what they're willing to do, and if we don't stop it soon, it's going to be too late. And that's why I think Australia, who are incredibly reliant on China for lots and lots of their trade, and the British, who were ready to go down the road and sort their 5G network out with Huawei, are basically falling into line with what America said early on, which is you have to draw the line somewhere. And Huawei seems to be the first place where the entire world is starting to say, fine, let's do it with this one and see what happens.
Well, let's hear some more of the thinking coming out of UK. Here is what you might call the sound of sand shifting. It's UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson speaking to Sky News, voicing his concerns over data security.
I'm very, very determined to get broadband into every part of this country. And I'm also determined that the UK should not be in any way vulnerable to high-risk state vendors. So we'll have to think carefully about how we handle that. We'll have to come up with the right technological solutions, but also have to make sure that we continue to deliver the broadband that the UK needs.
Nina Maria, could you decode that for us, please?
Well, I mean, it's as Paul says, Britain hadn't, up until recently, didn't really have the same national security concerns about Huawei as the US did. But the decision on Huawei and whether to drop it comes from a debate in Britain's House of Lords over adding an amendment to a bill which basically would regulate the installation of broadband. And that amendment was introduced by an independent peer who wanted language inserted stating that only telecoms operators with clean human rights records could be allowed to install high-speed internet connections in people's homes. And of course, that all pointed to Huawei. So I think what's shifted in the UK is that Boris Johnson is now coming under huge pressure from inside Westminster, which is not wasn't true a year ago. The pressure was coming from the US. But I think there's been a real change of political climate in the UK. Many people blame China for the coronavirus pandemic. And we're seeing domestic pressure on Boris Johnson to change course. Of course, mobile phone companies are warning of big network problems if Huawei is dropped. And I think one of the big problems for the UK is that Huawei is pretty well embedded in the UK's digital infrastructure. So, you know, it'll be a big deal if the UK decides to kick them out.
Now, the Trump administration gave formal notice of the U.S.'s withdrawal from the World Health Organization back on Tuesday, cutting off one of the greatest sources of funding for the organization amid a pandemic. Paul, why now?
Well, I mean, they threatened that they would do it. And again, this all comes back down to COVID. They said that the World Health Organization was basically duped by China. They didn't take their concerns seriously. This is about the American concerns seriously. And so they're taking away their money. And it's quite a lot of money. It's $450 million, which is about 15%, I think, of the WHO's funding. And, you know, frankly, I suspect a lot of Trump's supporters are also not big favorites of international organizations like the WHO, like the UN itself.
Yeah, so what impact does the U.S. withdrawal have on the WHO?
Well, it takes away a lot of money because the World Health Organization relies on America for a big chunk of its budget. So I think we will see other countries step up to try and fill that gap, certainly until we see who the next occupant of the White House is going to be, because Joe Biden has said he will join back up again on his first day. So I think for the time being, the WHO will be okay because other people will give them the money that they're going to lose from America. And it doesn't sort of kick in properly until July 6, 2021. So, you know, there is time for the WHO, but it's a big symbolic move.
Yeah. The World Health Organization initially acknowledged emerging evidence suggesting that coronavirus could spread through the air after 200 scientists signed a letter urging the WHO to update its guidance on the virus.
We have been talking about the possibility of airborne transmission and aerosol transmission as one of the modes of transmission of COVID-19, as well as droplet. We've looked at fomites, we look at fecal-oral, we look at mother-to-child, we look at animal-to-human, of course, as well. And so we are producing a scientific brief on summarizing where we are. We've been working on this for several weeks now.
That was WHO's technical lead on COVID-19, Maria Van Kerkhove, at a press briefing on Tuesday. But yesterday, the organization concluded that there isn't enough evidence that airborne coronavirus transmission is significant. So, Nina Maria, where does the WHO stand on airborne coronavirus transmissions now?
Well, it's another disagreement, I think, between the broader scientific community and the WHO. I mean, if you remember, the WHO refused for a long time to recommend mask wearing, partly because it was worried about the supply chains, but also it didn't really want to acknowledge also that people without symptoms could easily pass the virus on. This group of scientists say there's no doubt that the virus is released when people exhale, when they talk, that essentially means that people in indoor environments are at greater risk. And I think the ramifications are pretty big if that turns out to be right, because, you know, at the moment, people think they might be safe if they follow the current guidelines indoors. But it also has an impact on some of the lockdown and opening up decisions that governments are taking, like pubs and restaurants and bars in the UK that have recently reopened. You know, if the virus is airborne, it might not be long before we see a surge in cases again. So the WHO, I think, is under quite a lot of pressure from the scientific community to speak from the same page.
Let's turn now to foreign students. Harvard University and the Massachusetts Institute of Technology are suing the Trump administration. It followed an announcement on Monday that foreign students not enrolled in at least one in-person class this fall could lose their visas. All this comes at a time when many universities are deciding to hold classes online to reduce the spread of coronavirus. So, Jessica, lay out for us what this directive actually says, and what does it mean for foreign students this fall and for the universities themselves?
Sure. Well, first of all, I mean, for the universities, foreign students represent a huge portion of income. You know, up to 40%, for example, of MIT's graduate students that come from overseas. And under the new rules, if all classes are taught online, these students will no longer be able to come to the U.S. And so that raises all kinds of practical problems, including how do you attend a class which is taking place at sort of midnight or 2 in the morning in China or wherever else it may be. And then the other side of the new rule is to pressure universities to teach classes in person as well, which universities see as a risk to students and to teachers. It's definitely something that is going to be playing out until the fall.
Nina Maria, why is the Trump administration doing this?
Well, they're trying to pressure universities to reopen. So it's leverage, really applying hard leverage to American universities who are really caught between a rock and a hard place because, you know, many of them are on the brink of a financial precipice. I think the point about this move is, what does it say about America to young students all around the world who have a dream of coming to the States, who look to America, who admire America, and yet suddenly they're being told they're not welcome there? It leaves, I think, hardworking parents in China who've saved up all their working lives for their children's education to try and get them into a good university in a democratic, open environment. It leaves them completely in limbo. You know, what do they do with those places? Do they take them up in the hope that the decision will get reversed? Or do they do something that many might do and go elsewhere? I mean, Germany is set to benefit, Canada is set to benefit, and it leaves, frankly, America's global reputation among a group of young people internationally who couldn't be more committed and enthusiastic about studying in America. And you know, a talent pool that America could educate and transform and harness that talent, I think it leaves America's reputation in shreds.
Paul, could this force universities to open back up before they're actually ready?
It may do with some. I suspect they'll do kind of token things where they kind of agree to meet students once a week for maybe half an hour, whatever kind of loophole they can find to make this work. Because it is a massive deal. I mean, it's not just Chinese students, a lot of Indian students. And, you know, obviously Indian students have an Indian government, and the Indian government is an ally of America. So I think there will be an awful lot of pressure coming from the Indian government. And I think it would be a massive loss to America because a lot of these kids are really, really clever. They are the cream of their own countries. And America is getting, you know, the brightest and best. I mean, many of the countries that they come from are frustrated because the best people do go off to America and many of them do stay. So if you kind of turn off the tap of new, really clever young people, it's only going to damage America further down the road.
Jessica, you know, we mentioned that both Harvard and MIT are suing the Trump administration over this policy. Tell us, is there another way around foreign students leaving the country if their classes are all online?
I mean, I think as Paul said, if they really don't manage to get any, they don't manage to get the Trump administration to budge on this legislation, they may be forced to come up with workarounds that give students a chance to actually come to the U.S. But there's also, I mean, a broader problem in that globally, since the pandemic broke out, U.S. consular services around the world have been suspended. So many students have the opposite problem, that they won't be able to attend classes if they are held because they haven't been able to get the interviews that they need to get the student visas that they need.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there's pressure on either side for universities, and I think we'll just have to see where the lawsuit goes before the universities come up with a plan of action.
Now, after months of downplaying the dangers of the disease, even as his country's caseload surged, Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro announced Tuesday that he tested positive for coronavirus. Later that day, he shared a video to Facebook, and in it, he's holding a white pill up to the camera before popping it in his mouth.
Estou tomando aqui a terceira dose da hidroxicloroquina.
He says, I'm taking here the third dose of hydroxychloroquine, and added that the medicine is making him feel better, despite no proof of its efficacy by researchers. Jessica, so much to unpack here, but I want to start with how he's actually doing. How sick is he? Because some in Brazil are actually calling into question his positive diagnosis.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure that in Brazil, there's probably a lot of people who are hoping that his condition rapidly deteriorates. I just watched a video of him sort of yesterday, and he seemed to be pretty good. He looked a little tired, you know, a little bit haggard, but he definitely didn't look that bad. On the other hand, if you remember Boris Johnson in the UK, he got sick with coronavirus and initially seemed to be okay, and then ended up in an ICU. So I think that for those that are hoping that Bolsonaro's recovery isn't that swift, there's probably still some hope for them.
Yeah. And while we're on the topic of Bolsonaro, Nina Maria, on Wednesday, Facebook shut down a network of accounts that were indirectly linked to Bolsonaro's staff and family. What happened there?
Well, there was a massive backlash against the social media, and Bolsonaro has gone to war with social media. But, I mean, I think back to the point about him getting sick, what's fascinating about the denialists more broadly, whether you're talking about Brazil or Turkmenistan, is that even if we suspect the manipulation of data or misreporting or fake news, even if we mock them for denying the severity of the pandemic, you have to be a bit careful who you mock and where you point the finger. America is accused now of undermining the global effort for letting the virus get out of control. And I think we're still a long way from knowing who was right and who was wrong in terms of reopening strategies, but also in terms of intent. I think there's an argument that countries that frankly decided not to do much about lockdowns and in favor of keeping the economy going, it didn't in fact help them make any significant gains, and their economies are still hurting, you know, even if they never shut down. I mean, for instance, Sweden, if you compare Sweden to say Brazil, there is a prejudice, I think, in the way that we judge. We think of Bolsonaro as a hothead, as going to war with the media, of being volatile in his approach, but we talk about Sweden as if it's reasonable and sensible because they're Scandinavians. So, you know, is the intent so different? Why do we judge them so differently?
Paul, what do you make of how Bolsonaro's reportedly testing positive for coronavirus and his attitude about it relates overall to the situation in Brazil? You know, the country continues to struggle to clamp down on the spread of this virus.
Yes, it does.
And he's super casual about it.
He's super casual, and I think that's because, you know, he's in many ways he's kind of trying to out-Trump Trump, not just on the coronavirus, but in every aspect of Brazilian society. And he was voted in because he was a populist figure after what was considered to be a fairly incompetent government that preceded him, and in many ways quite corrupt. So I think the reason why people have gone after him so much is that, you know, Sweden may have done something that people say was not particularly sensible in retrospect, but that's about the only thing people think Sweden has not done very sensibly. Most of the other things that they do are quite sensible, whereas Bolsonaro is very much poking people in the eye around the world in many of the things that he does, in terms of kind of climate change, in terms of allowing the hacking down of the Amazon forests, in terms of his attitudes towards many social parts of a Brazilian society. So it's just the latest thing that Bolsonaro has done that's annoyed a lot of people. But the consequences in Brazil of not taking it seriously are quite profound. Yeah. And whereas Sweden has a very, very good healthcare system, as does much of Europe, Brazil doesn't. And it has lots of shanty towns where the virus can spread very, very quickly. So I think the consequences of his attitudes are likely to be much more dramatic, both on the economy and the health of his country, than perhaps those smaller countries around the world that also made similar decisions, but have the infrastructure to try and get back to where they should be.
Well, Jessica, listen to this email here that we got from Maria. She asks, does the fact that it's been declared a hotspot mean that people from Mexico and Latin America may not be allowed to visit or come to the U.S.? Your response?
I think that the U.S., as every other country in the world, are constantly revising the measures by which they're letting people in and out of their countries. And I think that Mexico has an unknown problem because their rates of testing are so low, and it could very well become a hotspot as well. And so I think that all of Latin America is looking that way. I mean, there's already a ban on Brazil, and I don't think that Mexico looks like it's going to be flattening its curve that much faster.
And yesterday, another South American leader also said that she tested positive for coronavirus, Bolivian interim president Yanini Áñez. How is Latin America at large doing in this fight against coronavirus, Nina Maria?
Not very well. I mean, it's as Jessica said, the situation is dire. We have a bureau in Venezuela where it's extremely difficult to get at the facts. There's been a huge degree of manipulation of data. People don't really know what's going on. You know, the suspicion is that the hospitals are overrun, exactly as Paul said. You know, public health infrastructures are collapsing. And I think, you know, there is a huge question over the moral culpability of governments like the Maduro government over their response and their refusal to share information.
Let's travel north. The president of Mexico, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, he jumped on a regular flight to visit the White House. And he was in town celebrating a new trade deal that replaces NAFTA. So it's called the United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement, or USMCA. Nina Maria, all this was signed off at the start of the year. Was this anything other than a photo op for the two?
It was pretty high stakes. I mean, Obrador had a lot to lose in this visit. President Trump happened to behave himself, but he has mocked Mexico a great deal over the last 4 years. I think the consensus is that Obrador managed to come out of the visit unscathed and not too badly humiliated. His critics, I think, back in Mexico basically think that he caved into every U.S. demand that was made of him, from the crackdown on immigration. He essentially accepts Trump's demand to send, you know, asylum seekers back to Mexico to await their fate. I think it helped that President Trump behaved himself. They didn't fall out. The Mexican president himself said that they didn't fight, but reactions back in Mexico were quite mixed. Polls showed 59% for him traveling to Washington. 85%, though, of Mexicans don't like Trump. I think he remains popular in Mexico. The current COVID-19 trajectory could change that. And I think the way that Trudeau maybe took a pass on the meeting probably helped the focus of the meeting, removed any huge tensions and allowed it to become a straightforward bilateral meeting.
Well, Jessica, you heard Nina Maria lay out some of the numbers for us there. But, you know, this was Obrador's first foreign visit and as president. Would you also describe him as a populist?
He's definitely, in terms of his approach to the Trump administration, has been one that's been practical. I mean, he can't afford to upset or anger Trump too much. Mexico is very dependent on trade with the U.S. And so I think one thing that was striking about the visit was that both sides played up their friendship when, as Nina Marie pointed out, they have a pretty troubled history, and Trump has said some pretty insulting things to Mexico, and he's more on the left-wing side. So, for him, this is just a very practical decision to keep Mexico's economy going, especially now that that COVID has put virtually every country under pressure.
Mm-hmm. What about Canada's part in this? You know, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau was not at the signing of the USMCA this week, the United States-Mexico-Canada Agreement. Why wasn't he there?
I think the Canadian relationship with the U.S. has not been the warmest, especially the past year.
Yeah.
Right,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so I think that for Trudeau, that to go to what, sort of, as you said, sort of as much a photo op for a deal that was already agreed, for him perhaps there isn't a lot to gain publicly by standing alongside Trump and smiling for the cameras. And there's still a number of risks to the deal because each side is already suggesting that they aren't adhering to the promises that they've made, Mexico on labor, Canada on opening up its dairy market, things like that. So I think that for him, standing down and sort of letting Mexico take the stage next to Trump, which is a kind of risky thing anyway, for him was a good decision.
So, Jessica, just put it in context for us, because both presidents gave remarks in the Rose Garden, you know, Donald Trump saying it was a proud moment. How big of a deal was it getting rid of NAFTA for him?
For him, it was a pretty huge deal because he's run on being the deal maker, and this is one deal that he's managed to really see through to the end, unlike the much touted China deal, which looks like could fall apart depending on where the U.S. relationship goes with China. Whereas this is one thing that he's managed to bring to a conclusion. Economists, however, are divided on whether this is actually going to bring significant benefits and changes to the U.S. economy and really create jobs. But I guess that's something that we'll just have to wait and see.
Let's take a turn here. Prince Andrew is again in the spotlight after last week's arrest of Ghislaine Maxwell, the alleged accomplice of Jeffrey Epstein. On Wednesday, U.S. federal prosecutors formally asked the prince to testify in the criminal investigation into Epstein's alleged co-conspirators. Paul, can you give us the latest here? Will Prince Andrew cooperate?
Well, his people say that he is. And the kind of difference between what the two sides consider to be cooperation is it seems that from Prince Andrew's side, he's willing to answer questions but in writing, and no doubt with his lawyers carefully looking at everything that's said, was they want him physically to sit down in front of them and be questioned. And it's very, very unlikely that the latter is going to happen. What we'll have to wait and see is what happens when the court case against Maxwell begins. I mean, she's due to appear on the 14th, okay, in New York. There's an awful lot of speculation about what she may or may not know. It's interesting to point out that the cases that she's been charged with don't cover the period that Prince Andrew is alleged to have had a relationship with one of the women that says that she was groomed by Ghislaine Maxwell.
You say there's some speculation about what she may or may not know. What are people saying?
I mean, there's an awful lot of speculation about that. But the cases that she's been charged with don't cover the period of the allegations that have been made so far against Prince Andrew. So he's not directly linked in terms of this case, but obviously he's been photographed with her. They were friends. And so, you know, people will be waiting to see what happens in terms of how the court case proceeds.
Now, to underline how serious this could turn out for the royal family, take a listen to what the Attorney General Bill Barr had to say on the matter earlier this week. He spoke to ABC News.
After he committed suicide, I said that I was confident that we would continue to pursue this case vigorously and pursue anyone who is complicit in it.
And I see where the department wants to talk to Prince Andrew. Do you think it's appropriate and do you want to talk to him?
Well, definitely the department wants to talk to Prince Andrew. That's why the Southern District has been making efforts to communicate and to arrange interview of him.
Nina Maria, give us the backstory here. Tell us more about the relationship between Prince Andrew and Jeffrey Epstein.
Well, they were friends, from what we know and understand, and he was friends with Ghislaine Maxwell. I mean, I think we don't know as much as we should, and that's why all eyes are on Ghislaine Maxwell's court appearance next week. I think from Prince Andrew's perspective, he's probably hoping that she names names that are bigger than him. He's probably hoping that that might overtake the FBI's interest in him. But just judging from that statement from Barr, I mean, I think the FBI is not going to let go of this. I think for many, and I think it's important that we talk about the alleged victims here, the way that he characterized Virginia Roberts back in February as a very sick girl, and the way that he's shown no empathy for Epstein's victims, I think it's really damaged him. He's not a popular royal in the UK. I think many here would be absolutely delighted to see him forced to answer questions. And I think there's also a big question over whether or not he's immune from extradition further down the line. It seems he was given diplomatic immunity as a trade envoy, but not as an individual. Technically, the Queen is the only one with sovereign immunity. So there's a debate here over whether, as a member of the Queen's household, he could be extradited. Mm. But yeah, there's a lot we don't know.
Yeah, you know, President Trump is a fan of the Queen, but, you know, for U.S. prosecutors to be going after one of her sons is unheard of. And so this sounds like a lot of strain could be taking place on one of America's closest allies.
It's definitely an uncomfortable position to be in for the royal family. And he was spotted by the tabloids earlier this week in the first sighting in a while, driving out of the gates of Windsor Castle. He's been keeping a very low profile, and that might be about to change.
Paul, as this investigation moves forward, can you just lay out for our audience why the interview that he gave to the BBC becomes more and more important here?
Well, it was just a car crash of an interview. He didn't show any empathy.
Wow.
He underplayed the serious nature of the sex crimes that Jeffrey Epstein was involved in. He just got the tone completely wrong. And it's directly what led to him basically withdrawing from public life. But I think what will also be interesting is Ghislaine Maxwell is a really big figure in the UK in the sense that she was the daughter of Robert Maxwell, which used to own one of the UK's biggest newspapers, who himself was involved in a massive scandal over a pension fund and was found dead off a yacht that he named after Ghislaine Maxwell. So, you know, she knows not only about Jeffrey Epstein, she's very, very well connected with the whole of the British establishment going back decades. So there may be an awful lot of people on both sides of the Atlantic that would really rather not hear what she has to say.
Absolutely. And Prince Andrew, how is he responding to all of these criticisms? Is he?
Prince Andrew, I think after doing the interview with the BBC, has decided that not responding
He's done.
Is probably the safest thing for him.
That's it. Well, the only time that we have left is to thank our guests. Paul Danahar is Washington Bureau Chief for the BBC and author of The New Middle East, The World After the Arab Spring. Jessica Donati is Foreign Affairs and State Department reporter for The Wall Street Journal. And Nina Maria Potts is Director of Global News Coverage for Feature Story News. 1A's senior producers are Danielle Knight and Paige Osborne. Our sound engineer and designer is Jake Cherry, and Matthew Simonson produces our podcast. They're all part of an outstanding team who helped make all of this happen. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, and distributed by NPR. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. Stay safe. This is 1A.